This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Embassy in Iraq says Sunday's rocket attack on its compound in Baghdad caused minor damage, but no casualties. The British government is set to hold a crisis meeting as more countries ban flights to Britain over the spread of a new coronavirus strain. And the COVID pandemic is devastating Gaza's ailing economy amid the Israeli blockade. We'll have a report from Gaza. Our top story, the U.S. Embassy in Iraq has confirmed a rocket attack on its compound in Baghdad's heavily fortified green zone on Sunday. The embassy says the attack resulted in minor damage but caused no deaths or injuries. It condemned the attack and called on the Iraqi government to take steps to prevent such moves and hold perpetrators accountable. According to the Iraqi military, at least 8 rockets were fired, with 3 landing in the U.S. Embassy. The military blamed an outlaw group for the attack without naming any. Baghdad's Green Zone houses 4 diplomatic missions and government buildings. The area has been frequently targeted in recent months amid growing anti-American sentiment in the country. A number of countries have banned travel to and from the UK to prevent the spread of more infectious strain of the coronavirus. The Netherlands, Belgium, Italy, France, Germany, Turkey, and Ireland have suspended or are planning to suspend flights and train arrivals from Britain. A German government official says that the entire 27-member European Union could adopt the restrictions. Iran has also announced a 2-week halt in flights between Tehran and destinations in Britain. The World Health Organization has called on its European members to step up measures against the new variant circulating in Britain. British health officials say the new coronavirus variant is spread 70% faster than the original and is out of control. The government has imposed a strict Christmas lockdown in London and southeast England to rein in the spread of the virus. Now, Iran has accused Canada of politicizing the accidental shooting down of a Ukrainian passenger plane near Tehran earlier this year. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh noted that Canadian officials from the first day have been trying to hamper efforts to probe the plane crash. He rejected as illogical the Canadians' repeated statements on the issue, saying that they're trying to use the tragic incident to achieve their political agenda at home and abroad. Khatibzadeh underlined that Iran officials, in coordination with international bodies, have been trying to resolve the issue. He said that Iranians themselves are in a shock for the loss of human lives. All 176 people on the Ukraine International Airlines flight died after it was mistakenly hit by a missile soon after taking off from Tehran. I should apologize for the mismatch on the video that was played. Now, the British government is to hold an emergency meeting to discuss international travel amid a surge in the coronavirus pandemic there. The meeting comes as several European countries have closed their borders to travelers from Britain. France said it would bar people as well as freight carriers coming from Britain for 48 hours. The UK has tightened COVID-19 restrictions in London and southeast England to curb a new wave of the virus outbreak. Now, those restrictions come as British companies are engaged in last-minute stockpiling before the year end. That's when a status quo transition period with the European Union ends and new customs rules come into effect. The coronavirus pandemic is devastating Gaza's ailing economy amid a crippling Israeli blockade. Lockdown measures to control the fast spread of COVID-19 have had grave economic implications. Ashraf Shannon has more in his report.
The coronavirus pandemic has worsened the dire economic conditions in the blockaded Gaza Strip, leaving a huge impact on the livelihoods of people in the tiny coastal enclave. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has already caused a sharp decline in the standards of living, as well as alarming levels of unemployment and poverty in the seaside sliver even before the pandemic. Meanwhile, tight lockdown measures to contain COVID-19 have had grave economic implications on all sectors in the Gaza Strip. Experts say the coronavirus pandemic has brought the blockaded enclave's economy to a virtual standstill, driving more Palestinians into poverty.
Economy is a vital lifeline, and the Israeli blockade has crippled this lifeline. The coronavirus restrictions have only worsened the situation. Currently, around 85% of the population live below the poverty line, with an average income of only $2 a day.
Lockdowns are directly affecting thousands of daily wage laborers and their dependents, and resulting in suspension of operations in the vast majority of businesses in the Gaza Strip. The coronavirus pandemic has added to the substantial financial strain already felt by many families living in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected economies all over the world. In Gaza, we're suffering the most amid this pandemic because of the ongoing blockade and the lack of resources.
The economy is in a very bad shape, especially during lockdowns, and shops and restaurants are closed. Many businesses had to lay off workers because they can't pay their wages.
The Gaza Strip has logged more than 33,000 coronavirus infections since late August. In an attempt to curb the rapid spread of the deadly virus, local authorities currently impose lockdowns from 6 p.m. until 7 a.m., and a complete curfew on Fridays and Saturdays.
We have imposed lockdowns as part of our preventive measures to slow the spread of the deadly virus. The Ministry of Interior is sparing no effort to minimize the number of coronavirus cases. The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is very high, and we are trying different approaches to contain the virus.
Experts say the pandemic will exacerbate the underlying humanitarian crisis that has gripped Gaza for years.
The COVID-19 pandemic is adding extra strains on Gaza's ailing economy. All economic sectors in the impoverished enclave are already suffering because of the Israeli blockade and multiple wars. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Now, there is no let-up to pressure on Pakistan, reportedly from the UAE and Saudi Arabia, to normalize ties with Israel. This after some Arab countries diplomatically recognized the Tel Aviv regime. Pakistani Prime Minister has rejected media reports on his country's preparedness to recognize Israel. He once again promised not to do so, citing a widespread public resentment against Israel. Javed Rana reports.
They are living in Pakistan. Their hearts are with you.
He is a Noordari, a man of Pakistani origin. He's heading a London-based anti-Muslim think tank, Islamic Theology of Counterterrorism. Dari is suspected to be sponsored by apartheid state of Israel. Dari, who left Pakistan almost 20 years ago, has been now at the center stage of what Islamabad says a lingering disinformation campaign propagating that Pakistan is getting ready to normalize ties with Israel.
Pakistan government, they want to establish a relationship with Israel. This is the reason they sent a delegation. And not only the one person, a couple of persons, including the advisor of the Prime Minister, they flew from the London to Tel Aviv.
The claim was immediately dismissed by Pakistani Prime Minister as baseless.
Why would our delegation visit Israel when we have a policy not to recognize Israel? It is clearly a fake news. In a democratic society like ours, it is unacceptable to normalize ties with Israel, because our entire nation stands by Palestinians.
Pakistan has been reportedly under intense pressure from the UAE and Saudi Arabia after some Arab rulers normalized their ties with Israel, notwithstanding the seething public anger in their countries. Both the UAE and Saudi Arabia reportedly threatened Pakistan to expel its an estimated 4 million expatriates if Islamabad resisted their pressure to normalize ties with Israel. This followed a few news anchors who were encouraged by Pakistani military to start debating in favor of normalizing ties with Israel, an allegation denied by army known for calling shots in country's foreign policy making. The media outlets in the apartheid state even find it hard to speak with a credible Pakistani journalist.
Many Pakistani journalists would even decline to appear and speak with me, speaking with from our studio in Tel Aviv.
Pakistani journalists who spoke recently with the Israeli news channel are either tainted with the corruption charges or had desperation to come into limelight through controversies. Anyone supporting Israel in Pakistan meets with instant condemnation at social and mainstream media, given Israel's unending mass killing of Palestinians and their forcible expulsion from the Muslim Holy Land from 1948 to onwards. The major thrust of the argument of the lobbies working for Israel and its allies has been to cite Arab countries abandoning Arab nationalism in occupied Palestine for an independent Palestinian state. However, theologists point out that forcing Israel to withdraw from Islamic Holy Land is not an Arab cause, but in fact it is a greater cause of Muslim nationalism beyond color, creed, and geography, something which overwhelmingly prevails in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Now, in other news, negotiations over a post-Brexit trade deal between the UK and the EU have once again reached a deadlock. Both sides have put on a brave face, saying that they have no problem if there is no deal in the end. In our news review program, my colleague has discussed the latest with our guests.
Welcome. Britain says significant differences remain with the European Union in negotiations over a post-Brexit trade deal. A senior British government official said talks would continue on Monday to explore every route to find a deal. Previously, the two sides had set Sunday as the deadline for the talks. Negotiations had been particularly stalled over the EU's fishing rights in British waters. A bloc's diplomat said if Britain doesn't accept the latest offer, there will be no deal. The two sides must get a deal by December 31st. A no-deal scenario would mean border chaos for both sides and reliance on World Trade Organization rules that could possibly lead to price hikes. Joining us on this edition of the News Review is our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, and we also have James Tweedy, journalist and commentator on international affairs from the British city of Plymouth. Gentlemen, welcome. Jerome, if I could start with you and get the latest there in Brussels. The UK saying it wants a substantial shift from the EU, otherwise no deal.
What we're hearing now is that the EU side, namely Michel Barnier, negotiator on behalf of the European Union, is offering something in the region of 25% of the value of all fish caught in British waters by EU fleets. That 25% of the value of this of these catches would be given to the British fishing industry. But what we understand is that London is saying, no, that's not enough, that it would need to be something in the region of 60%. And on the other hand, so Britain's saying it's not enough, but the actual people representing the fishing men, the fishing industry, the fishing organizations are saying that 25% would be far too much. And that literally for people like the Irish fishing fleet, for example, that it would put many of them out of business if they had to give a quarter of the value of the catch back to the UK. So you can see that there are major differences on this issue, and there are some other problems as well in relation to this. But you'll also remember that Michel Barnier said on Friday to the European Parliament that this is the moment of truth and that we're in the final hours and we've just hours left to reach a deal. And then we know that we had this 12 o'clock midnight local time, Brussels time, for a deadline that was put forward by the European Parliament to get a deal, and we know now that that is going to be passed. It's yet another deadline that we go past, and we know that they're going to continue negotiating tomorrow. And Barnier has said, you know, that look, the UK is asking for an awful lot here. They're trying to get a trade deal in a 9-month period. When you look at some of the most recent trade deals that they did with like Canada and Japan, those deals took 4 to 5 years, and they were much less ambitious and much less complex than the deal that they're trying to strike with the United Kingdom. So he also says, look, it was Boris Johnson who said back in June there'll be no extension to the transition period, there'll be no extension to these talks. And so it's actually the UK, from the EU's perspective, it's the UK that is creating all these problems by putting unrealistic deadlines in place.
Yeah, and James, we don't want to, you know, play the blame game, but we're going to have to. Who do we blame here? The EU or the UK for stalling these talks?
The EU and the UK have different aims in these talks. I mean, the UK wants trade, and no strings attached. The EU wants kind of divorce settlement through the courts for years, and the UK just wants to be friends with benefits, basically. So, yeah, so the EU wants to attach all sorts of conditions to free trade. we can't necessarily do with free trade. They, for instance, they want Britain to continue indefinitely obeying regulations made in the EU. Now, we're not just talking about trade standards. We're not talking about the standards applied to how goods are produced, because if those goods were going to be exported to the EU from Britain, they would have to comply with the European basic standards that you see. But we're talking about any kind of regulation made in Brussels, the British government is going to have to adopt, so why did we leave? And then on the fisheries, okay, you know, we're talking about, again, a kind of indefinite situation where the European fishing fleets continue to take something like 90% of the fish from British waters. British territorial waters, you know, the exclusive economic zone is a very large area. The corresponding areas of many European Union, you know, continuing European Union states have largely been fished out. They've wiped out the fish in those areas. And French fishermen now say that they can only really catch fish in British waters. But they send very large boats from the Netherlands to British, much larger than we use here, and take a huge amount of fish, and that also kills other marine wildlife like dolphins and porpoises. You know, so it's the whole thing is generally a disaster, and has reduced the size of the British fishing industry, which could recover from that if we had that back. But yeah, the EU wants the kitchen sink, everything but the kitchen sink thrown into the deal, and Britain just wants to remove tariffs.
Let's thank our guests for their contribution and their thoughts. Jerome Hughes there, our very own correspondent in Brussels. James Tweedy, journalist and commentator on international affairs, joining us from Plymouth. And that brings an end to our news review for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Now let's move on. A Chinese aircraft carrier group has sailed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait on its way to conduct a military drill in the South China Sea. The Shandong carrier group sailed through the narrow strait the day after a U.S. warship transited the same waterway. Taiwan said it had dispatched a number of warships and aircraft to monitor the movement of the Chinese fleet. Tensions escalated between China and Taiwan after the U.S. approved multi-million-dollar arms sale deals to Taipei last month. Beijing considers a self-ruled island a breakaway province waiting to be reunited with the mainland. It maintains sovereignty over the region under the One China policy. Well, the U.S. Senate Republican leader says congressional leaders of both parties have agreed on a coronavirus relief bill worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
More help is on the way. Moments ago, in consultation with our committees, the four leaders of the Senate and the House finalized an agreement. There'll be another major rescue package for the American people. If our citizens continue battling this coronavirus this holiday season, they will not be fighting alone. We've agreed to a package of nearly $900 billion.
The package is expected to include aid for vaccine distribution and logistics, extra jobless benefits, and a new round of stimulus checks. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer also conferred the agreement, stating that a vote will take place on the bill soon. This as the pandemic continues to take a heavy toll on American people as well as the economy, which has been battered by rising jobless claims. COVID-19 has claimed 317,000 lives out of more than 17.8 million cases in the U.S., the world's worst hit country. That's all for this broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert. With the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Deserts or playas are wonderful phenomena of the nature. There's starry sky at night. There's mysterious silence during the day. There's sweltering winds which move in every direction with a bizarre sound. All in all, entice you to visit these lands. Today, we are going to take an exciting trip to a very beautiful desert at the heart of the central desert of Iran, to Dagh Sorkh Playa. The central desert of Iran, which is called Dasht Kavir, has placed many smaller deserts in itself, one of which is Dagh Sorkh Desert. Dagh Sorkh Desert is located in proximity of Zawar city in Isfahan province. The length of Dagh Sorkh Desert is about 50 kilometers and its width is 20 kilometers. This desert, with its low-height mountains, along with its thick forest, is detached from the central desert of Iran. The middle area of Dagh Sorkh Desert is swamped with so much salt that even salt-loving plants or halophytes don't exist in the area. The peripheral scenery of the desert is diverse and is highly affected by the scale of humidity as the erosion caused by the wind. I am now in Dagh Sorkh Desert. Here, there is a huge sand hill, which is home to the region's eagles. That is why this area is called the Eagle's Nest. Oh, just above, in the sky, several giant eagles are flying. Oh, flying of eagles is really magnificent. It's interesting to know that there are mines of salt, gold in the Dagh Sorkh Desert, and probably there is also oil here in the desert. Well, the rustling of my shoes on Earth is because of the fact that a thick layer of salt has covered the surface of the desert. At night, the moonlight brightens this playa, and then the salt crystals reflect the light back. Dagh Sorkh Desert must be a really musty place to see at night. am now in a part of the desert which is called Thar Forest. Thar Forest is an important factor for stabilizing the running sands of the desert. If this forest didn't exist, Zawara City and its villages would have been buried under piles of sands many years ago. I have now reached to a part of the Dagesorh Desert, which is called Talle Shaitan Dune Hills. The hills of this section look like boomerangs, which gorgeously show us the wind direction. These sand hills are really beautiful. I'd better take some photos from these crescent-shaped hills. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the New York Police Department has been found guilty of using aggressive disorder control methods and adding to tension during massive protests. The demonstrations broke out after the killing of a black man, George Floyd, in Minneapolis. While the Department of Investigation has found systemic problems in planning and response by the NYPD. Now, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio was also criticized for his response during the spring protest. So what does it all mean, and will it bring about a change? Stay with us as we take a look at this on this debate. We're going to start it all off crossing over to Washington, D.C., and let's talk to correspondent Colin Campbell. Colin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, Colin, break it down for us. Exactly what does it mean?
Well, it looks like what happened here is that the mayor, Bill de Blasio, commissioned a report asking for how police responded to the protests brought upon by the death of George Floyd, the man who was killed in Minneapolis after a white police officer kneeled on his neck for more than 8 minutes, leading to his death. And then, of course, we saw the protests happening across the country as many people identified and saw that there were disparities in policing in white and black communities. Now, in New York, where we had these protests, the investigation showed that police used excessive force in the way that they tear gassed people, in the way that they arrested people, in the way that they responded to these protesters, at some points driving police cars into the crowd. And if we remember, in Charlottesville, Virginia, when there were protests there, that is how one woman died. Ms. Byard died by a white supremacist driving his car into the crowd, killing someone. So the implications there are very great, that police could have killed people as they were trying to, quote unquote, do their jobs. And I think what this shows is that there is a serious issue when it comes to policing protests, policing communities of color. This is a long-standing issue, not something that has been an issue or a problem in the past decade or 2 decades or 3 decades. It's been more hundreds of years since the inception of the United States of America. And what we're showing is that even in the 21st century, there are still problems with this that need to be resolved.
All right, thanks so much for that update. That's Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome our next guest to the program. Out of Philadelphia, social justice activist Yanni Narago. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, what do you make of this investigation overall?
You know, it's interesting, and I appreciate the comments of my colleague who was speaking before me, because this has been an ongoing issue, and one of the things that people don't look at often is the history of police, and there are a few histories. There's a history that recognizes that before there was a police patrol, there was a patrol of individuals who were a slave catching patrol, and the connection between those is easily discerned, even especially if you just look at the badges. The sheriff's badge, which is a star badge in the U.S., the U.S. sheriff, is the same badge. It looks the same as the badge that slave patrol individuals used to wear, and so. In both of those instances, the purpose of the police was to protect property. At that time, people were considered the property of those who were wealthy. And this entire police district in the U.S. is really geared to protect the property of the wealthy, whether it's people property and their ability to exploit and use people and exploit people's labor, or it's actual, like, physical property, which is demonstrated when you look at the example of Breonna Taylor, when there was no indictment for her murder, but there was indictment for the bullets that missed her body and hit the property around her. One of the things that they talked about in this instance with New York, and they've been talking about this in a lot of instances across the country recently, is this need for reform. And there are a lot of these people who are leaders who are saying, we've got to do better, we've got to do some sort of reform. And I think the reason that you're beginning to hear this, what's the new narrative that's coming out, there was a recent murder in Philadelphia of a young man, Walter Wallace, who was having a mental health episode and needed support and was murdered. And what the narrative was of the police at that time was that those individual officers were not trained properly for that situation. And that's the same thing that they're saying now with the investigation, that these officers were not trained.
Okay, stay with me, Yanni. We're going to continue this discussion, but let me get my next guest in on this. I'd like to welcome out of Newark, co-editor of Anticonquista, Nicholas Ayala. Thank you so much for being with us. You heard our guest there in Philly and basically saying that perhaps the narrative is changing. Now they're talking about as far as the techniques that have been used and why it's being used, your take on this. I mean, we have this investigation out of New York talking about and criticizing some of the techniques that were used. It's not the first time that we've had investigations that have actually found some type of abuse by police. Is it going to make a difference this time around? Do you think that changes would be implemented?
Well, one thing that's interesting about the report that came out of New York is, like the previous guest was saying for me, a lot of it comes down to they put the blame on a lack of training, that the officers were ill-prepared to deal with such huge crowds. But in New York, we saw, one of the things we saw in the summer was police officers running over people with cars. I'm sorry, but that doesn't come down to a lack of training. That comes down to what kind of person you are and morality. And I think that these reforms that are being pushed by the New York Police Department and the mayor are really just more excuses to try to distract from the real evils that exist within the New York Police Department and really the whole U.S. Police Department. And, you know, these reforms, again, they're not going to, like you said, we've seen them try to push reforms over and over again. When Obama was president, we saw that after the death of Trayvon Martin, there were many pushes for reforms, and there were reforms. They added body cameras onto police officers, and yet 4 years later, we're still having this problem. So I don't think these reforms are really going to achieve much of anything, and they really distract from the bigger issue at hand.
The bigger issue at hand. Well, let me turn to Philly. What do you think the bigger issue at hand is, Yanni?
One of the things, the point that I wanted to make, which was started to be made also by the person who just spoke right before me, is that there's a move and a push right now to abolish the police and to create new systems that are actually equitable and just in the United States, where people and communities will actually be able to be protected and safe. And I think that this narrative around reforming the police is an actual effort to push back against the real need to remove this unjust force from our communities and replace this force with something that is built actually with care and protection for all in its core, because that's not how these police are. So the police come and they come with weapons. There was recently a video of a woman who was whose apartment was battered into, and she was naked, and they handcuffed her. Nine male police officers walked around with her standing completely naked while they moved around her apartment, which was not even the apartment they were supposed to be going into. The police don't have concern for these communities. Many of the people are not even from our communities. But even when those kinds of adjustments are made, it doesn't transform anything, because at the core of the system, it is an unjust system, it is a violent system, it is an occupying force in communities, predominantly Black communities, communities of color, and poor communities, and that's not going to change. What needs to change is the existence of these forces in our communities.
Right, so let me just jump in here, what you just said, because you're saying basically occupying forces. So if there are any kind of changes, how far would these changes go, and could it get to the crux of the problem if, according to what you're saying, these are occupying forces? So tell me exactly what you're saying here.
So when you have outside individuals, they are not, for the most part, people do not police their own communities. People are policing other communities. So they are not desired in many of these communities, and they come in with weapons, and they impose their force and whatever it is that they feel, because they have the authority of being police officers, because we have systems that will believe police officers no matter what they say, and often even when there's evidence against them that is on video, there's no kind of relief against what it is they might do in our communities, and therefore they are a military might. We have police officers, we have police districts with tanks that show up in our communities. They have weapons that are weapons of war that they use in our local police departments against our communities. That is a war-like force, and they are therefore an occupying force in our communities. They need to be eliminated completely and replaced with something that's good.
Well, what about that, Nicholas? You heard Yane basically talk about the occupying force and saying they bring in weapons of war. I mean, if we recall Ferguson and the situation Mike Brown in that small town, we saw tanks on the street. And yet we know that there's a difference of how the police usually react in mostly minority or mostly Black areas, as opposed to, for example, if it was a white affluent area, and how they would respond. So with that being said, and basically that this is systemic racism, how can it be changed, policing in the United States?
Well, I think the reform movement is one step, is one one path towards the right direction, but you know, you need something more concrete. You need something that goes a little bit further. The Abolish the Police movement is a very serious movement, a very serious consideration that we need to be looking at, because what that does is it really tackles the more, and it looks at the systemic issue of racism that runs rampant within the police community. But not just racism, it also comes down to classism, because like we said, or like you just said, the police, they're there to protect private property. They're there to protect, you know, white, affluent neighborhoods. And we saw the difference when there were protesters out at the same time with the BLM protesters. There were anti-lockdown protests in May and April. Those protesters who had weapons were treated far better by the police than any of the Black Lives Matter protesters. So the issue really comes down to is the system, the society that the United States has set up. How do you really fix that is by attacking those core beliefs, those core stereotypes and biases that these people come into the force having, right? And in order to do that, again, you need to tackle the issue of systemic racism. That gets down to abolishing the police, because the police are, like the previous speaker said, they are an occupying force. You know, we saw in the last few years more people in the United States have been killed by the police than U.S. soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan. I would describe that as a war, and that's a war against our own people that's going on right now in this country. And the only way you stop a war is by attacking those soldiers, or by stopping those soldiers who are engaged in that war. In this case, it's the police. So the only way we tackle this issue is by getting rid of them and wholly recreating the system, which is an institution, which is the police institution. It needs to be based more so on rehabilitation rather than punishment. It needs to be based on understanding of the community's needs, particularly poor communities and black and brown communities, because right now, again, as the previous speaker said, we have police forces who are not from these communities going in to try to protect and serve them, but doing the exact opposite. And that's because they don't understand, they don't connect to the community like people who are from there actually would.
Well, Yana, if you've both spoke about abolishing the police and that this movement is growing, tell me about that. What exactly does that mean? Now, Nicholas just pointed out that it means concentrating more on rehabilitation, but how would that work? There are some critics that say that, as a matter of fact, if you abolish the police, it's actually going to be the minority community then that will suffer, because the more fluent communities will have their private guards and protecting them, and it would be basically the poor communities on their own. How would you respond to that?
Well, the thing is that the police serve those same affluent communities. They don't serve our communities. They don't prevent crime. They show up after crime is committed. And they often show up when there's no crime actually being committed, and they commit harm. And so the police does not protect poor and minority communities. The police are a tool of capitalism, and they use racism and they use classism in order to protect the capitalist interest. But really, it's not even that it's a racism that is driving the issue. It's because racism is used. It's the communities that actually serve the best, the capitalist interest the most. And in this moment, the minority communities don't serve capitalist interests that much. And so that's the reason why there are individuals who are protected, even if they're not wealthy, because they align with the capitalist interests. And so what we're working to do in this abolish the police movement is to actually go back to where we used to be, when black people couldn't call the police when we had problems. We had to handle and take care of our problems ourselves. And we did that by having collective communities that took care of each other. So we are building community at the local level. We are building relations at the local level. And we are building responses, and we're building anti-crime realities. Most of the time when there's a lot of crime in these issues, it's because there's a lack of security, because people are hungry, because people are impoverished, because people are housing insecure. So if we address those issues, we can take the budgets that are in the police department, we can use those budgets in order to address the issues of security in communities, and that will automatically lower the amount of crime that happens in communities, and then be able to build relations so when people have problems, they can turn to their neighbors, they can turn to individuals who know them, who care about them, who know their histories, and those people can help them solve those problems. And we have found through examples, through models, through statistics, that the programs that actually function like that have a much better violence prevention rate than the actual police department's programming. So there's already evidence that this type of a shift is actually beneficial to poor and minority communities.
What about that, Nicholas? How likely will it happen as far as the powers that be? When you're living in a capitalist system, and part of capitalism is actually having that lower level want to be used as workers to oppress and basically, that's a very big part of the capitalist system. So with that being said, then how do you transition to something else when you're still existing in that capitalist system?
Well, part of the strategy when you're first starting is to build what's called dual power. So you want to build, a power structure in the same place in these communities that rivals those institutions of power from the government. And that's really what we're seeing. I think this is what we're seeing on the ground now to some extent. In some places more so than others. You have mutual aid groups who are coming out. You have groups that are coming out to watch ICE and track ICE and keep immigrant communities safe. You have police watchers, more and more people who are making sure and tracking the police, making sure they're not doing harm in their community. These are all methods and strategies which begin to build that base of community, which essentially rivals the power of the police. And when you do that, you start no longer needing the police. And again, it should also be important to point out that part of the issue, like we were just talking about, is that economic issue. A lot of the violence, a lot of the problems, the crime that comes from our poor communities stems from the fact that there's poverty, not so much the fact that there's racism. And that poverty is really what we're trying to challenge right now, right? The mutual aid groups, they give out food, they give out clothing. That helps fight the violence more so in our community. That helps fight violence in our communities more so than the police going out there and cracking people's heads with batons or whatever, or shooting people dead, because that's how the police respond. They only know how to respond to violence with violence, whereas here, when we talk about meeting our community needs, we're talking about feeding our community. We're talking about giving people food, providing shelter. That way that they don't have to be on the street. That way they don't have to struggle to survive. That's the first step, and that's how I see it continuing in the future with this movement.
Yone, the future of this movement, we saw these mass protests taking place for months throughout the country this year. Do you see the dynamics of the demonstrations like we saw this year continuing? And your prognosis for the future, do you see, in general, protests continuing, or do you think things will quiet down?
I don't think things will quiet down, but I don't know that it's going to be protest-oriented. Here in Philadelphia, what a lot of the reorganizers have been doing has been shifting from a protest and mobilizing movement to an organizing movement, where we are bringing more and more people together in order to address our own problems and to exact our own solutions. And so I think that there's a change that's not going to be eliminated, right, in the ways that people are thinking and the ways that we want to engage with each other and what we believe we have the right to and what we're willing to fight in order to have for ourselves. But I don't think that protesting, what people are realizing is protesting is one piece, and it's a way that people can come together to express their pain and their rage, and to know that they are not alone in those feelings. But that has not changed us from, you know, Walter Wallace was murdered in October, and those protests were happening all summer long. So, you know, there have been so many people, I've had so many comments who have been firebombed, who have had crosses burned in front on their lawns and have been murdered. Organizers have been murdered in Louisville and in Indianapolis and all across the country. People are being arrested by the feds and by different people targeted for their protesting. So we know that protesting alone is not going to do it. We have to build our own power. We have to build our own solutions. And that's where the shift is going, into much larger communal transformation processes. And that's what we'll be seeing as we move into 2021. And that's definitely what's happening in Philadelphia.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us. Out of Philadelphia social justice activist Jan Nedogo, and out of Newark, co-editor Anticonquista, Nicholas Ayala. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
I am a man.
spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. Last night we continued our discussion about the plan of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for having a society for mankind in which justice and then other values which come under justice would be implemented. And we talked about the historical role of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam. We talked about the Prophet Muhammad. We talked about the central role of Mecca in this plan. And the last verse that we discussed was from Surah Baqarah, verse 143. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا. As you remember, we said before this sentence and after this sentence, there's a discussion about change of qibla, direction for prayer. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inside this discussion, makes a very general point. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we have made you a middle, a balanced nation. Allah has planned in the way that Rasul is shaheed for us, he is a witness for us, and by following him, and in particular by making sure that we don't go to any extreme, then we become example for other people. This shows how balance is important. Among many other qualities, Allah says this is one of the central and fundamental qualities. I decided to read a few hadiths about this important point, and I hope, inshallah, we all rationally follow this discussion. You know, I am very worried that people, you know, may sometimes misunderstand this important point, but I have responsibility to say this, you know, anyway. Imam Reza alayhi salam, in his famous hadith to Ibn Shabib, you must have heard part of this hadith because frequently mentioned about Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Ya ibn Shabib, in kunta baqiyan fabki lil Husayn. فَبْكِ لِلْحُسَيْنِ ابْنَ عَلِيهِ فَإِنَّهُ ذُبِحَ كَمَا يُذْبَحُ الْكَبْشَ. O son of Shabib, if you are going to cry for anything and for anyone, try to cry for Husayn ibn Ali. That is the most important thing for which you can cry. Even if you have sometimes, you know, personal problems, or, you know, if you lose your dear ones, still, it's better to cry for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Even if you cry for that person, somehow connected to the cry for Imam. Alhamdulillah, we have this habit in community that when we lose someone, we have funeral, we mention the musibah of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Why? Because Imam was killed in a very brutal way. فَإِنَّهُ ذُبِحَ كَمَا يُذْبَحُ الْكَبْشُ. I cannot translate, unfortunately. It's very painful. وَقُتِلَ مَعَهُ مِنْ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهِ ثَمَانِيَةَ عَشَرَ رَجُلًا. And 18 men of Ahlul Bayt, out of 72 or some 70, 18 were from Ahlul Bayt. They were killed. مَا لَهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ شَبِيهُونَ. None of these 18 had similars in the world. You could not find anyone like those 18. You couldn't find anyone like Abul Fazl, anyone like Ali Akbar, anyone like Ali Asghar.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Then Imam continued and reached this point. Yabna Shabib, in sarraka an takuna ma'ana fi darajat al-ula min al-jinan. If it makes you happy to be with us in the highest levels of heaven, fahzan lihuznina wafrah lifarahina. Try to be sad and to have grief for our sadness and grief, and try to be happy for our happiness. Because when you love someone, then automatically when that person is happy, you feel happy. And when that person is sad, you feel sad. It's natural. I cannot love you and when you suffer, I feel, you know, relaxed. In some other lectures, I have explained that especially this is true about sadness. The unity that is established between two people who share happiness is much weaker than the unity which is needed when two people share sadness. You know, sometimes a person has a birthday party. They invite you, you go there and you are happy. You don't know that person, you don't have that much affinity. But to smile, to laugh, to eat cake together, it's not difficult. I can, you know, share this experience with many people. But someone says, my father has passed away, please, you know, come to the funeral. Then, can you easily cry for him? No, it's not easy. You only cry for that person if your heart is really united with that person and you feel that his musibah is your musibah, his suffering is your suffering. This sympathy is based on strong unity, which cannot be tested when you smile together, when you celebrate together. So the power of crying and sadness and grief is much more than being happy. You know that there are some communities, you know, some sects in Shia Islam, they don't have any sad occasion. You know, the Ismaili community, they only celebrate happy occasions for Ahlul Bayt, only birth anniversaries.